Post-Arlen Monologics. Number 00028. Recorded on March 15, 2023. Production location, Post. Arlen. Texas. Midnight Pie. Midnight Pie. Chapter 28.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Along with all the other trash that's blowing up onto this parking lot. You know, the mundane routine of it all. The shit that's always out there, it seems. We've got this little seasonal twist going on, right? Here come the Easter marketing cards. Brochures. What do I mean, Easter marketing, all right? We are coming into the spring season, and it is, as such, the Easter season, the Passover season, the, I don't know, what the May Day season, whatever the pagans of the day are calling their little spring solstice festival. But the onset of spring, what I'm trying to get to, comes Easter, and with Easter comes mass marketing appeals from all these churches, Protestant churches, almost exclusively Protestant. I never see Roman Catholic or Orthodox advertising, right? There's an attitude that goes with the more ancient of the Christian churches. That's a redundancy. Church is Christian, right? Like the idea, like the church is Satan. No. Church is actually a Christian thing. So try not to convolute terminologies, all right? So anyway, the Protestants, it's a marketing opportunity. They've got a target market. Who's the target market? The seasonal Christians, right? It's a seasonal, what's the word I'm looking for? Effort, right? A seasonal effort towards seasonal people. What do I mean, seasonal people? Seasonal Christians. These are the people who are Christian, but like barely, right? They were raised up in a Christian environment. I don't know. Everybody's got their own different story. But come Christmas and come Easter, all of a sudden, there's like, well, maybe I ought to check in with God kind of attitude, right? And, of course, most Christians will tell you that that's not the way to fly, right? Now, that being said, there's a lot of people that have a lot of problem with, quote-unquote, church in general, right? Like, they believe and they pray, but they don't go to church because they have problems with churches, right? And these are people who, you know, I was one of them. I was one of them, right? When I started out, before I was a Christian, you know, sworn on my face to Jesus Christ in tears, right? and accepted, right? Accepted. I knew when suddenly God was hearing my prayers and responding and starting to be a, not, I don't mean to say active or present part of my life. I mean a conspicuously active and present part of my life, right? Or I could tell. It was evident now. It wasn't just, in retrospect, looking back, you can see, well, yeah, God was there and God was there. And that's all true. Things change when you come to faith. God is always there. You see him in action as he's in action, right? So I was at that place long before I went to church. It took me how long? A year plus as a Christian person in that regard to even walk in the door of a church. I shopped around online. I did everything online. I looked here. I looked. I couldn't find nothing. I could find nothing at all. You know, so I understand, and I know that there's a lot of people around, you know, there's a lot of people around. The conversation with me always comes up. You're going to be my friend. You're going to be like my lover, you know, romance. We're going to talk about church and where that is in your life and where you are in its life. And, you know, I've had these conversations that come up this way. It's like, well, you know, I'm a Christian and I believe and I pray, but I don't go to church. Just me and churches, you know, and that's almost always how it goes, right? And so I get it. So these are the kind of people who are out there not going to church that these Protestant churches come Easter time and Christmas time, they're going to start to make an effort to draw them in, right? And, you know, it's all business. It's all business. Is it good if people show up at church and get involved with fellowship? Yeah, in the regard that we are not an island unto ourselves, right? Going at it our own way, interpreting the scripture our own way, if we're involved with scripture at all. See, the thing about being in a fellowship with other quote-unquote Christians is the Bible's going to be a present part of your life. In conversations and in practice in your day, everybody's going to say, well, you know, check, you know, Jesus said in this book, in chapter such and such, at this verse, la-da-da-da-da, you know? So you got to go and look at that for yourself and take it in. And then, you know, you become the answer to other people's question in that regard as you learn the Bible. Bible becomes very central in your faith. And so there's a goodness in being involved with any kind of Christian community. When you're a Christian, it helps to kind of keep you from falling into your own private interpretation of Scripture, of faith, And making your own religion. This is what Protestants are made out of. It's people that just take that Bible for themselves, figure it out their own way, run with it. And if they happen to have some kind of charm, some kind of magnetism in their personalities, they'll start to accrue a following. And it's not really based on that person's knowledge. It's based on their magnetism, right? So, you get a lot of fucked up shit as a result of that. And then when you get the fucked up shit, what happens is people who want church, they come to faith, they go seek out a church, they see the fucked up shit, and then they decide that they don't want to be a part of it no more. It comes back and bites you on the ass. You know, it's just whirling dervish that blows through faith. And it's the season. You know, it's the season. That's what's happening now. And, you know, so it's, what season? The Easter season, right? Easter. And yeah, there's people that are pissed off about that. Just that word Easter, right? Easter. Where did that come from? Easter, you know, they blame like Roman Catholicism for co-opting pagan cultures throughout Europe as it spread. And so many of those cultures related back to, you know, the gods and goddesses from the origins of civilization, you know, like Sumeria, you know, Mesopotamia out that way, the Babylonians and the Akkadians and the Sumerians, and what they all collectively had was a goddess named Ishtar, right? With different variants. And this is not my expertise or my specialty. I remember being a fledgling Christian and coming into this discovery and this argument and this conversation with other people, you know? We use the word Easter, and it's all really based on this goddess Ishtar, and it's all wrong, and it's all fucked up, and we ought to come up with another name, right? And they do, you know. You'll find pockets of Protestants around there that refer to Easter instead now as quote unquote Resurrection Day, right? Because that's what Easter is. It's the day that Jesus came back from the dead, you know. 3 days in Hades, and the train of believers, and Abraham's bosom, all that stuff, right? And he comes back and makes himself, so it's the day of his resurrection, and it's like this great, wonderful day. It is the Christian holiday, all right? And it's really not just Christian. It is the continuation of Passover, right? It's Passover, like, realized and kind of extended in a way, right? And there's a lot to that. I don't mean to get into all that right there. But what's interesting is, you know, it's like you get these people that redefine. First, we call it Easter. Then we redefine it as Resurrection Day. And then these fucking redefines. You hear me bring that up every once in a while, right? When I was like a COBOL programmer, right? We had this, and I talked about this, and I don't want to get into it before, but the first time I ever saw the word redefines was part of COBOL programming, right? Common Business Oriented Language. It goes way back. It's the old mainframe, what's it they call it, third or fourth generation programming language. But they had a term when you were setting up and defining your data called redefines, right? And then since then, there's just like all this redefinition of everything. Going from, back then, I mean like the grunge era 30 years ago, right? That's when I was doing that shit. And from that point forward, it's like you're just seeing all of these words, you know, being redefined, taken, stolen, repurposed, whatever you want to say. And I've gotten to the point where it's like every time I see like a word being, and I'll use this word again, co-opted, right? I see a word being co-opted, its meaning being fucking changed. It's a stolen word. It's redefined. I regard it as quote-unquote gayish, right? Gay. All right, now, you faggots out there, don't get all up in arms because I said quote-unquote gayish. Okay, what I don't mean to say that it's like a thing that gay people do. What I mean to say is it's a thing that happened to the word gay, okay? So sit down, take a deep breath, shut the fuck up, all right? And let's approach this now from the proper context. What I mean to say, when all these redefinitions of things are quote-unquote gayish, it's what happened to the word gay. Gay, once upon a time, simply meant happy, joyous, you know, exuberant. And then it was co-opted somehow, some way. And I don't know the etymology or the cultural history behind it all. I've got inclinations. I've probably read it somewhere, but it's not all that important to me. So I probably, you know, it's in like those dusty back pages of my database in the skull there. But yeah, once upon a time, the word meant happy. And then it turned into homosexual. So that's what I mean by gayish, right? It's what happened to the word gay. And like, homosexual, that wasn't even the word for gay people. You know, that has an etymology that I did look up because I was curious about that. That goes back to the 1890s. I actually thought it was more current than that, but no, it goes back to the 1890s. And it was a replacement, you know, it was like a one-word replacement for a two-word phrase that in the 1800s, what we know as homosexual or gay now, what's called sexual inversion back then, right? So you got like an inverted sexual inclination, I guess, is what the theme of it. Now you go way, way back, you know, traditionally, homosexuals and homosexuality was known as, you know, sodomites who practiced sodomy, right? Just like Sodom and Gomorrah in the Bible. And that long tradition stood. And also from the Bible, the word reprobate is used. Reprobate. That, when I hear or see the word reprobate, right? And this is not a co-opted word. Or sodomite. These were words that were used traditionally to describe what we now use as gay, right? I hear the word reprobate. The first thing that comes to my mind is that salty old codger, the radio talk show host who in the 80s and 90s worked out of New York City at WABC. And I think there was some other station he did also a little bit before that out of New York. But I didn't know him at that point in time. I knew him in the late 80s through the 90s when I would kind of touch base with like political talk every here and there. I always listen to talk radio, and you know, ridiculously, talk radio is strictly sports and politics. So if I'm into sports, I'll go through a phase when I'll listen to that, which ain't no more. That's done. But back then it was, and then politics, it kind of comes and goes too. You know, it pisses me off before long. It starts to wear on me and drain me, and it takes over. And it's a lot of hooey. It's a lot of bullshit. You know, if you listen to any kind of political talk radio every fucking 10 years, you're more or less hearing the same shit over and over again. It's just recycled. The faces change a little bit. Not always. You still got some of the same people there. It was career politicians, right? And you'll have these talk radio guys, the same people complaining about the same people, and most of the scenarios and situations being the same fucking thing over and over and over and over and over again. And it's like, you know, you heard it once, you heard it all. But this guy, though, this one particular guy, his name, Bob Grant, right? Bob Grant. And he always used that word. And like when he used it, when I first heard him using it, I didn't even know what the fuck it meant. You know, I didn't know what the fuck it meant. And no, I kind of put it aside. It came up later in my life. But while I'm right here, all right, while I mention Bob Grant, sadly, right, sadly is a little influential on me. I found the guy humorous in his saltiness, but he was a mean-spirited person to a lot of people that would call into his show, right? But sometimes that was funny, and it was worth to listen for a little while. So in some sense, he's influential, just because anybody who I would listen to is going to have some kind of influence on me. I hate to make it a regard that, like, what I do at my monologue is something that was generated by this Bob Grant guy, right, who was so mean-spirited. I am just not that mean-spirited of a person, nor is a guy I grew up with who also does these podcasts. In fact, he was way more influential than Bob Grant was, but we both listened to Bob Grant back around that same time, and we have similar stories in that regard. So there was a little bit of influence as far as just radio in general and talk radio, talk shows in general. We both listened to the same person, and this person is Frank Nora of the Overnightscape, right? Frank Nora of the Overnightscape. I'm bringing him into this this discussion right now as a little side jag, because it's worth mentioning. He has done the Overnightscape podcast for a solid fucking 20 years now, as of like 2 days ago, right? So it's done. He did it. And he is creeping up on episode number 2,000. 2,000 times. What I'm doing right now, can I see myself doing this 2,000 times? I would love to. It almost seems like I would never live long enough, right? That's a lot of information out there. A lot of man hours, and You know, a lot of his podcasts through time have run much longer than what I do over here generally, which I keep it around an hour, hour, 15 minutes for the most part, with exceptions. But yeah, 20 years, 2,000 episodes, The Overnight Scape, Frank Nora. Congratulations to you, Frank Nora. And the rest of you out there, look it up, overnightscape.com. That's strictly him. But he has created, established a community of people who do these podcast monologues called the Overnight Scape Underground, right? Little side project of his, but he's actually written a book involved with this whole thing, right? O-N-S-U-G, short for Overnight Scape Underground, onsug.com, O-N-S-U-G.com, and you will find not only me, but others doing this sort of same thing in Frank Nora's network, right? This is his network of people, and you get a whole variety over there. Obviously, I'm going to say things that piss you off. I'm going to say things that make you cringe. I'm going to say things that make you want to put a pistol up to your fucking temple and blow your brains out. And if you have that kind of response to me, fret not, because I am way different than everybody else out there. You go out there and you're going to find all kinds of things that you'll find comfort with, right? So it's a variety. There's no rules. There's no like particular genre or anything like that. No belief system. Definitely worth your time. And they ain't selling you nothing. You know, it ain't, you're not going there and getting hurt. Like I'm talking about like this Easter marketing and shit right there. You're not being sold anything. It's just people doing this. More or less for the sake of doing it. And you can find a voice that's friendly to you as you peruse it all. And who knows, it might inspire you to get up and share your voice with the world. Anyway, reprobate, I was talking about that word. Now, that's a kind of a bad word. That's kind of a bad word. It's a powerful word, right? It's a powerful word. Like I said, it comes from scripture. Right? It's a way to describe a homosexual, as we call them now, traditionally was sodomite, which came from the Old Testament. In the New Testament, you got this word reprobate, and I don't know the original Greek behind it. That's the English translation of some Greek word. The English word we know is reprobate. And there's a chapter that Apostle Paul wrote in his letter to the Romans, right? Romans 1, so like right up in front of center. You get a couple paragraphs into it, and it starts to talk about people who are reprobates and what it's like and their lifestyle and the choices. And I guess if you're one of them, it's really hard to digest, and you get a pretty much of a triggered response to it all. And as that chapter of that letter goes forward, it gets into all kinds of lifestyles that are immoral, according to Apostle Paul, right? And so it ends up pissing off everybody equally. Everybody's got something, right? And it's in there. But that Romans 1, it begins, it involves that word reprobate, and it's like the reprobate chapter in the Bible. And I think a lot of the contemporary hatred of Christianity, really all the hatred of Christianity, it's going to be generated by the morals of Christianity that poke at the things that we do and say that, sorry, that's bad, that's not good, that's evil, that's wicked, that's immoral, that's sinful, right? But no, that's what we do. That's, you know, it's a thing that we do, and that's what we like, and that's what our life is kind of built about. And now you're telling me that I'm wrong for it all? Fuck you, right? So we've got this hatred of Christianity down through the ages, and the contemporary form is really the attack on the church is coming hard from these reprobate, sodomite, homosexual, gay-oriented type of people, right? An example, right? It's like in Romans chapter 1, right? You had the similar, written also by Apostle Paul. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul gets into that whole line again of all these different immoral lifestyles, amongst which is, you know, men sleeping with men. However, your interpretation defines it. It ends up being homosexuality, even a couple of different sorts of it, right? If I remember correctly. And that is the scripture that was quoted, oh, like 10 years ago, to a TV show or a magazine by Phil Robertson, right? The Louisiana hunter guy, the Duck Dynasty dude, the duck caller guy with all the beard and everything, and the family, the you know, all the rednecks running around. And well, he was in some kind of interview, and some kind of question came up, and he made reference to 1 Corinthians 6. He may have even read it out loud, and it duly pissed a whole lot of fucking people off, right? Specifically the homosexuals, gay community, right? Because it equates homosexuality with all these other lifestyles, in and amongst them, and this was specifically noted, right? The scripture referenced by Phil Robertson was making equality with the practices of homosexuality and being a drunk, a drunkard, right? So it's like this guy is expressing scripture that is putting alcoholism, drug addiction on the same footing with homosexuality, with sexual immorality in general, really, right? But pissing off that, what do you call it, LGBTQ community specifically. Because we're sensitive like that, right? We're all sensitive like that. We just got to freak the fuck out. And it was a costly thing. It took a very popular show and pretty much killed it. You know, killed it. Not dead. He's still out there doing his thing. And yeah, at the time when that happened, we actually had a, for lack of a better word, a house lesbian. Now, that's not the way that I think of this person. It was a young woman who was an addict and an alcoholic who became friendly with my ex. And my ex was the type to take on strays. She liked every kind of troubled person. She hated my fucking guts, but she liked all these, you know, she would see a guy picking through trash as we're driving down the road through a city or something like that, and she'd start crying. She'd see somebody with a tattoo on their face, and she would think that's so sad, she'd start crying. But she'd have me, you know, her compadre right there with her going through life, us against the world. She hated my fucking guts. And it was just, this has nothing to do with nothing. It was just a really weird dynamic. But she had this tendency to pick up strays, and one of the strays she picked up, right, was a young woman, and she happened to be a lesbian, and this whole Phil Robertson thing happened while this lesbian was staying with us in our house. And while we're doing this, I'm facilitating these Bible groups, and I'm trying to get this young girl involved with it, and It's a ruckus. It's just, it's very difficult to be confronted with morality, whatever your background and interests may be, right? We have a natural aversion to be to being told that we're wrong about something that we are really beholden to. So it was a weird thing. And it ended up playing out really weird, but that ends up being a different story. All right? Now, Phil Robertson, going back to him, he is a preacher for a what's called a Church of Christ, right? Church of Christ. That's a line of churches, mostly through the South here, but there are little spitterings and scatterings of them pretty much everywhere. predominantly little small country churches, but larger ones in bigger towns have developed. And like here in Texas, they're everywhere. Across the South, you'll always find them. Church of Christ, right? And they're Protestant, and they got their different little way of looking at things. And what's interesting about them is, well, they're one of assorted group of Protestant churches that really have this desire to wipe the slate clean and go back and do church the way the apostles did it in the beginning, right? I call it the Protestant reinvention follies. This has nothing to do with Phil Roberts, and this is just what he's in, right? He's in, but in my regard for him, a very Christian man, a very well thought out man, a guy who understands things very well, but quite possibly independent to a fault, maybe. But still, I would let him baptize me in a river, you know. His what he's had to say about things has been very helpful to me over the years. I don't mean to bash him or really anybody. I'm just trying to tell it straight. This Church of Christ thing, it's part of a movement that came out of, like, I guess the 1800s. Every weird fucking thing happened in the 1800s in this country, or started then, and then grew from it. Western civilization, North America, United States specifically, and most commonly through the South, but not necessarily only there. A lot of California shit, a lot of Northeast shit. It just fucked up. Everything fucked up. You know, a lot of things that were fucked up that grew out West started out East and moved over. Just all kinds. But this particular quote unquote movement was called the Restoration Movement. What's that? Restoration? Restoring? It's restoring the church to its original way of doing things. But lost on these people, and this is why I regard it as follies, right? Lost on these people is the fact that you have a church in the world that actually is apostolic. It actually does things the way it was done. And that's what everybody has run away from, to go and invent their own shit, right? And that is Orthodox Church. And this is the reason I looked into it, because I wanted to do things the way things were originally done. Before we got there, we went to Church of Christ. I had started out, the church I finally settled on after that whole first year when I became a Christian was a spinoff from a Church of Christ, right? The Churches of Christ are known for what I just described, right? Their desire to return to the old apostolic way of doing church. And most specifically, and a part of that is that their music would be strictly a cappella, voices, no instruments, right? So your regular Protestant person, your church experience is, well, you've heard me say it before, the pseudo U2 concert, right? For most of it. That's not always the case. I had good times going to Southern Baptist churches in Tennessee where the music was done bluegrass style, right? You get 3-4 guys up there doing bluegrass music. They actually had touring bands 3 weeks out of the month. They would go church to church, and then every church had its own house band where they, you know, like the pastor played bass and sang tenor, and you know, it was really good. It was really good music, but it's not the way church was done in the apostles' times, right? From the beginning, it wasn't that way. This is just the way these Southern Baptists in the hillbilly regions did it. I liked it, but that doesn't make it authentic, right? That doesn't make it the real deal. So I was going to quote-unquote non-denominational church that was really a spinoff of Church of Christ, but they did the pseudo U2 music, right? Not the whole production and everything. It's probably a little much to call them pseudo U2. You would just have a couple of, you know, young people up there playing music, right? It wasn't really like a full-fledged concert. It was very ordinary, common Protestant stuff, not Church of Christ-like at all. But their basic worldview was very Church of Christ, because their staff, their leadership, all came out of the Church of Christ into this spinoff. That's what I started with. That's all I know about this stuff, right? I know about this stuff. But I'd gone to that spinoff of a Church of Christ for, on and off for quite a few years. And I had never really gone to an actual Church of Christ. So when my wife and I were starting to look out for something very new and very unique, and I had the idea in my head of, something authentic and original, I knew that the Church of Christ were at least trying to go back to the old way of doing things, right? And we went, and it was like I said, it was Protestant church with a cappella singing. As far as being anything close to apostolic, as far as drawing any kind of mysticism into it, a priesthood, all that, it wasn't there. It wasn't there at all. Iconography, not there. There's things that I knew about, or there's things about the apostolic church that I didn't even know about until I finally walked away from all that and entered into Orthodoxy. And that happened through a guy who was in the motorcycle club that I was hanging around, right? I was about to start prospecting. We had a little Baptist men's Bible group, and this guy showed up. VP, right? He's not just some dude. He's there. He's an integral part of that network of men. A good bunch of guys, right? Really good bunch of guys. But he interrupted our Bible study with all kinds of Orthodox stuff. And as soon as I heard that word, the flags just went up in my head. The lights went on. And I was like, this is the guy I was waiting for. I need to try Orthodoxy. I knew a little bit about it, because of my grandparents being Ukrainian Orthodox. I needed an American version of it that I could try. Not Ukrainian, not Russian, not Greek. I don't speak those languages. I need something American. And it turned out this guy was going to an American version of Eastern Orthodoxy that I never heard of. And that's how I got to where I'm at now, through him. You had this this intent going back to the 1800s of people who wanted to restore the apostolic church and do things the way it had always been done from the beginning, completely without the knowledge that it existed and has existed the whole time, right? Because what? Protestantism and Roman Catholicism, or Western Christianity, and Western Christianity completely dominated here. There was no Eastern Orthodoxy in the United States. If there was, it was very little. Outside of what? Where did it come in? Alaska, through the Russians when they owned Alaska, right? Before the Seward's folly, selling Alaska to the United States. They were pioneering Alaska and establishing Orthodoxy over there. That was the first entry point of Orthodoxy into this country. And then you started getting, in the early 1900s, the waves of immigrants coming in from Eastern Europe, like Greeks, for example, Ukrainians in my family, more Russians coming into New York City, everybody coming into New York City, the melting pot, the original melting pot, and establishing their churches, which were very ethnic. Their services were done in their language. All the people who went to them were culturally Greek or culturally Ukrainian. And that was it, And because they stand, they stand on their own as the church. They're the old church. They don't go marketing their shit. And Roman Catholics, who were part of that original church originally, are the same way. They don't go marketing about. They're there. They are the church. They're in the town. You want them, you go find them. Where the Protestants go door to door, literally door to door, knocking on your door, handing you brochures and praying with you, going out and getting you. And So you had this movement in the 1800s of people who were trying to reestablish the original ways. They were called Campbellites, right? Named after some Campbell guy. Was it Alexander Campbell? I forget exactly what Campbell's name was. And he had a partner in all this too. And it was actually born out of Kentucky, right? Kentucky. Kentucky went from the great long rifles to the great Bowie knives to these Campbellite people. Kentucky bourbon, right? You had all these great things that come out of Kentucky, and then you get the Campbellites, and that's kind of what we're left with now. So I mentioned about this apostolic church, right? The apostolic church being Orthodox Church, which Roman Catholicism was a part of originally, and then they split, went their own way, doing their own thing, right? This was the kicker for me. Understanding there was a great, we know as schism, or some people say schism. It's a word related to scissor, right? Cutting. The great, I'll call it schism, right? The great schism, S-C-H-I-S-M, right? The great schism was a cutting away of the Roman patriarchy from the four other major patriarchies in Christianity as it was at that time. There was no Protestantism then. Protestantism is a protest against the Roman Catholic Church, the Western Church. So, you know, who left who? Who banished who? It's all a matter of perspective, but the fact is you had four on one side, one on the other, and then the one had already started doing things that were contrary to the agreements that they had, these councils that they had through time, the seven ecumenical councils that established what was heretical and what was not heretical, and other things as well, all involving the church as a whole, but it was all run independently, out of hierarchies called patriarchates, right? Patriarchates. It's the father system of hierarchies. It's really bishops in big cities, and then there's lower bishops in smaller cities, and then you get into like the priesthood and the rest of the clergy through the deacons and subdeacons and everything like that. And, well, the Roman patriarch of Orthodox Christianity, the patriarchy, their bishops through time, and they were all regard, because the patriarchy is father, right? Patriarch, like matriarch is your mother, patriarch is the father. The patriarch of a patriarchy is regarded in terms of fatherly, and that's where the word pope comes from. So you had the bishop in Rome was the pope, and the bishop in Jerusalem was a pope also. They didn't call him that necessarily, but it's the same thing, right? It's the father figure of the patriarchate. The patriarch in the patriarchate, is a pope. So Rome had their pope, and part of the problem was trying to establish their pope as superior, more powerful than the other popes and the other patriarchates. That caused friction, understandably so. But even prior to that, they were changing agreed upon terms from the ecumenical councils, starting to do things their own way. And once that great schism happened and the split occurred, they continued to do things differently than the rest of the patriarchates. So all those rest of them patriarchates, what we call Eastern Orthodoxy, they've been doing shit the same agreed upon way from the beginning. And that's what I wanted to involve myself in. And now we're going back to Easter, right? We were talking about the word Easter, the argument that people have with its etymology, involving that Ishtar goddess of Sumeria and Akkadia and Babylon. The word Easter, the use of the word Easter, actually comes as part of that whole Roman Catholic thing, that which was inherited by the Protestants when they split away from Roman Catholicism. You know, Easter for the Roman Catholics became Easter for the rest of Western civilization. Meanwhile, out east, in the lands where nobody gave a shit about, because they're Eastern and they think different and they think funny, you know, they don't call it Easter, and they never did. Who knew? Who knew? It's called Pascha. P-A-S-C-H-A. Like I said before, what we know is Easter is relative directly to Passover. It's actually, you know, like an addition to the Passover celebration is Easter. Jesus Christ, you could say in a way, co-opted it, but it was always about him. The Passover was always about him. You know, it was about the Lamb of God. He's the Lamb of God. It's his celebration. That's a lot to get into. Wow, I think I was going this direction at all here. Step it up a little bit because we're going to do a reading and it's a long one, right? A long story, probably the longest one that there is. But yeah, it's called Pascha. And the way it's celebrated is different too. Like Easter as we know it, whether you're Roman Catholic or Protestant, some kind of Western Christianity, that's a spring day and everybody comes out with their bonnet and their flowers and it's all springtime and daytime and just lovely, right? In Orthodoxy, it's different. First of all, like, you know, the Orthodox days, the liturgical days begin like sunset, like they had traditionally always been through the Old Testament, right? The old Israelite times, their calendars, their days, they started at 6 p.m., you know, sunset, and ended, you know, the next one around, where we start our days at 12 midnight. You know, these ancient Christian and Israelite days started at sunset. And that's how our Pascha is done. We do Pascha, starting at night. And, you know, we're in services through the night until like 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's a great thing, a big celebration. The whole liturgy changes and stays changed for months, and a lot more singing, and it's really, really a good time. But it's late at night, and it's rough, you know? And then at 2 o'clock, we have tents set up outside, big tents, you know, big party tents, and everybody's bringing feasts of food. Every family is bringing like baskets and barrels of food and wine and whiskey, and it's a party. And it goes on all night long, right? And then it picks up again in, like around lunchtime, and then all afternoon again, right? It's a big deal, right? But it's not called Easter. So if you have that argument about Easter being related to the goddess Ishtar, and we should not be doing this stuff, let's call it Resurrection Day. No, just call it Pascha, because that's what we've always fucking called it. We just here in Western civilization, Western Christianity, have no idea that that's what's going on. It's fucked up because, you know, even me growing up, like I said, I had Ukrainian Orthodox people in my family. They didn't bother to call it Pascha for me. First of all, they wouldn't call it that. They would call it by some Ukrainian word, which I don't know. Russian-Ukrainian word. Probably very similar, right? I should know it because I know enough people in my church that are of that heritage. But my family, the Ukrainians in my family who spoke English, were always kind enough to just call it Easter, as any American would know it to be. And I had two Easters because, you know, old school Eastern Orthodoxy runs off of an old school calendar. Our calendar in the West is different. It's off, and I don't know what the difference is. It's like a week or two or something like that, generally. Our church is actually running on the Western calendar, the modern common calendar. But you go to Ukrainian Orthodox, you go to Russian Orthodox, the Ethiopians, they're celebrating their Pascha at a different time, and their Christmas at a different time. It's all offset. So as a kid growing up, having Ukrainian Orthodox family, but being Western and having Roman Catholic family, I would have two Christmases, I would have two Easters, you see what I'm saying? I would have all this extra stuff, and I didn't understand it, you know? It's fucked up that it's that way, because now you got to explain that, the differences, and it gets into the whole division of everything Christian, which is the suck point of it, which is the reason why people want to go back and do it the way it was originally. So here, ladies and gentlemen, is your assimilation point for doing Christianity the way Christianity was meant to be done. There is one place for everybody to go where it makes sense. Kick the tires on it. Give it a try, right? If you're curious, of course, you may have to accept the fact that your immorality and lifestyles related to immorality might start to dissipate and fade. What? If you're going to do it, just give it a try. It's something that none of us think about. None of us, like we all think about. Anybody who thinks about this stuff at all, I should say, thinks about doing it the right way. You don't want to do it the wrong way. What's the best way? What's the best church? It's always a consideration for people. But this is the answer that never comes back. And that's like how fucked up civilization has been towards Christianity. It always finds a way to bastardize things. It always finds a way to run you off course and make sure that you never find truth. It always finds a way to keep Christianity divided, if not slaughtered, right? Fucked up. So I had two Easters, two Christmases. Now, Halloween, here's an interesting thing, right? Halloween, Orthodox view of Halloween. The regards for Halloween is it's a highly regarded holiday in Orthodoxy. Did you know that? You know that? You dark people out there who like all kinds of spiders and spider webs and scary things and ghosts and goblins and ghouls and... It's actually a well-regarded holiday that we are expected to celebrate. The perspective on it is that we are mocking the demons. So you dress up as a demon as a mockery towards it. Act the fool as a mockery. In the same manner that the Romans and the Jews mocked Christ, right? This is mocking back, in a way. But yeah, interesting, isn't it? You know, Halloween is... Halloween used to be cool. We were kids. I mean, when we were kids, it was fucking cool. I remember if Halloween fell on a Saturday. Right? I remember living in Greenbrook. One year it fell on a Saturday. I was out like 9 o'clock in the morning till like 9 o'clock at night trick-or-treating. I was carrying multiple costumes with me. I was, what was I, 8, 9 years old? I had pillowcases, like 4 of them, I think, full of candy. I had money, like change, dimes and pennies and nickels and quarters, enough to buy me. I remember on the way, we stopped at the Friendly's Ice Cream, right? Friendly's Ice Cream. It was a chain up in the Northeast, maybe New Jersey. I don't know where it came from. I should look. I don't even know if it's still there. But we had one in Greenbrook, and I loved it. Everybody loved it. You know, that was like the place to go. And we stopped over there during our trick-or-treating. Got like, you know, ice cream. That's what they did. But they also had like burgers and shit like that. We had all this pocket change just from everywhere we've been, enough to pay for all this stuff and like feast out, right? And, you were free to be. And everywhere you went, every time you turn around the corner, there was more kids. Kids were everywhere out trick-or-treating, doing this shit, and it was just a big deal and a great time. It didn't have to be Saturday, you know? If it was on a Tuesday, you got out of school, you ran home, you jumped into your costume and went out there, kids all over the fucking... Now, no way, no way, no way. And I'll give you a reason why the no way, right? Because, like, long before, like, before I was born, a cousin of mine, Ukrainian Orthodox up in Canada. She went trick-or-treating up there, and somebody got gave her chocolate-covered mothballs, and she ate one or two or three of them, and she got really sick, like she was going to fucking die. All right? I saw a newspaper article about it that my aunt had kept, and you know, there's scumbags in the world. There is now, and there always has been. It's just now there's so many more people in the world. You got more scumbags in the world. And Halloween has become just a scary thing for parents to have to put their kids through. You know, for a long time now, for 30 years or more, 35 years, our culture in this society has been very protective of the children. Ironically enough, many children are being abused and molested. it's weird. It's a weird, offset, polarized dynamic going on in this world. In this civilization. But yeah, there's a fucked up world then, a fucked up world now, and you know, it still is done. It's still done. It just ain't the same as it was. And you know, like, I couldn't imagine my mother walking around with me, like parents walking around door to door. Maybe if you're like 2-3 years old, yeah, because you don't know what's going on. You're just learning what you're learning it, right? But when you're like 8-9, get out of here, Ma. I got this, you know. I'm going to get my fucking candy, and I'm going to eat what I want to eat, and stop where I want to stop, and hang with who I want to hang with. All right? But no, not now. In fact, at the Southern Baptist churches, Protestant churches in general, they've come up with this, they call it a trunk or treat. They basically do like a tailgating thing in their own parking lots where it's safe for all the families. They're getting candy from their own people, you know, and they're using that again as a way like to bring families in the community to their church. They advertise for that. So if you're like some sort of secular or other type of antichrist motherfucker, but you have kids and you want to have Halloween and do it safely, and you trust the Southern Baptists in your neighborhood, you could go over to their parking lot and go around and get candy off of them, right? And they'll try to hook you in and keep you. And but that's how it's being done now in that regard. Yeah, it's just low trust factor in humanity. Well, rightfully so. Rightfully so. Well, we've proven to be fucked up people. Even our best motivations, where children are concerned, you know, to be so protective of them. Yet at the same time, they're coming out all fucked up because of the shit that we're doing to them. Behind the scenes, behind closed doors, you know. I don't know. I'm going to get into this one of these weeks. Pay attention, you know, unless you're like easily triggered, or I'll put a warning up. But I want to talk about that stuff. That's kind of been on my mind. But I made this commitment to reading these chapters of the old novel beginnings that I stumbled upon, right? And I think this is the last one of them, right? But the Halloween, like now as an adult, no children, I hardly even know, like, it's Halloween. Kids don't come to the door. Of course, we don't advertise it. We don't, you know, that we're participating. We don't have all the jack-o'-lanterns and all that shit, right? Which is kind of like a friendly way of saying, hey, we're doing Halloween, so come on up here, kids. Right? But, I mean, I don't see much anybody doing it. On any block you go down, you might see one or two houses, and they probably the houses that have the young kids in them, right? People aren't participating, and you're really not seeing kids going up and down the streets. My neighborhood would be a great Halloween neighborhood. Houses are small, tight together. It's a city neighborhood, you know, like what I had when I grew up, when I was a little guy. And no, the night falls early, you know, it's late, the end of October. You're pretty thick into the fall by then, and the time change has already occurred, daylight savings time change. And you know what? You look out the window, and every once in a while, you'll just see, like, one kid, the mother, the father, the flashlight just kind of like cutting its way through the dark, right? Very quiet, no ruckus to go with it, and they're just looking for a friendly place to go up and do the trick-or-treat thing. It's sort of kind of sad. I'm getting carried away with time here. Let me do the reading and move on, okay? This chapter, and it's going to be a little long in the tooth, I think. And that's why I want to get on with it. It's called Midnight Pie, right? Just like I was saying, right? A flashlight, right? Kind of going down the street. You see it going out into the darkness, and it's like a big slicer going through like a black pie. And this is what this is, Midnight Pie. You'll see what I mean, right? Somewhere in here. I ain't read it in a while. No, it's right from the start. All right, you'll get it. So it's a convenient little segue here, okay? Without any further ado, the reading du jour. And I'm pretty sure it's the last one I got. I gotta say at this point, yes, there is a little bit of a do, okay? There was more. I had written much more. The best shit is out there to be found, but I can't find it. I wrote characters and scenes, chapters, where I was actually creating my own language. There was some fucking cool shit happening, but I have not stumbled on that. And I may never. So this is the last one of the ones that I have found, and it may be the last one ever. Most regrettably, but I'm not going to pick this project up and go. I thought about that. I think I thought about it out loud in one of the monologues, but no, there's just no way with everything I'm doing, everything I've got going, there's no chance of me writing a fucking fiction novel. It ain't gonna happen. Not anytime soon, right? Not anytime soon. Now, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Midnight Pie. Out in the deep and heavy darkness of a sultry summer night, the dim beam of a flashlight floated along, floated like a feather on the face of a snoring old man. It bounced along as lightly and as carefully and as steadily as the man who guided it, and then it skipped and dove and sailed just as erratically. This small sliver of forbidden fruit in a deep dish of midnight pie. The bearer of the torch was a lone young man with a backpack, feeling a way through the deep, heavy dark, whispering with the still silence below a lush green canopy of soft living pines, wading through the haze upon a vast orange carpet of their ejected, dead, and hardened needles. He cupped the black rim of the metal flashlight with his free left hand, managing the peripheral glow carefully and keeping the fraction beam pointed at the dry, spiny ground before his boots. He towed lightly and patiently, keeping both his breaths and his steps low to the ground in a slow, faint shuffle, each step a concerted undertaking, each step having its own tale to tell. His entire being squirmed uncomfortably with any crackling and crunching, and he would pause paralyzed in a flashing jolt of this sort of this short and sharp mild terror. At each pause, he carefully squatted down and ran the light low across the forest floor, stealing cheat glances into the near distance. As far as could be seen in the awakened tract, within the light, were a zillion rusted needles of pine straw, a random scattering of gray finger bone twigs with pale green warts of lichens and the gray-brown slithering serpentine loblolly roots meandering into and gliding smoothly under the row he so patiently tread. He shuffled ahead ever as slowly and raised a shirt sleeve and wiped his sweaty brow. After about 10 such paces, he heard a faint chirping, a low riding, a high-pitched, mousy squeaking, and paused into a slow crouch. He rode the light out ahead, carefully throwing the beam with a cupped hand. There were only the endless rusty needles and gray roots to be seen. He angled the light across the floor to his right, but saw only pine straw, twigs, roots, and trunks. He pushed the light around to his left and saw only more of the pine forest sprawl. The faint chirping continued, broken and random. He carefully straightened himself upright and determinedly shuffled onward. After 6 more paces, the low squeaks came louder, thicker, and busier. He cast the beam around his perimeter again, and again saw nothing but pine straw, pine twigs, and pine roots. He shuffled forward some more, and the chirping became as near as present in him, seemed as near as death could be on his shoulder, humming old field spirituals into his waning soul. He paused and squatted, cast the light sharply into the floor of pine straw at his feet, gently reached a hand down into the rusty needles, and peeled back a dense swatch to expose the moldy, sandy soil. A shiny black cricket scampered off into cover. The man, again, lifted himself upright and shuffled onward, wading along behind the feathery light. The squeaking enveloped him, reaching up from below like some wanting hell of torments, but the forest floor continued to lay eerily still. He shuffled another step and suddenly threw himself a panicked and contorted step back. "Fuck, fuck, 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 fuck," he hissed rapidly, and dumped the light haphazardly to the ground. He bent over and swatted maniacally at his face. "Fucking shit," he bitched out loud. He had laid his face full into the alarming ripple of a thick, sticky cobweb jabbed with the beefy lump of its scampering resident. He groaned, a rising crescendo of revolt above the squeaking and chirping darkness, frantically drawing another step back and maniacally slapping his hands about his nose and cheeks and forehead and neck. In the vagrant glow of the abandoned light beside the man's left shoe, a thick and hideous orb weaver with banded legs of red and black trampled quickly into the depths of pine needles and disappeared. The man bent down, retrieved the flashlight, and orchestrated his breathing with an angry fist pushing futile into the haze before him. He pointed the beam to the forest floor, still rusty, still spiny, still eerily still. He shuffled ahead a couple of paces quickly to regain his lost progress and paused. He shined the light on the floor ahead, and once again, though the teeming chirps from the ground all about him, he saw nothing but the endless and still pine forest carpet. He shuffled ahead, quietly and slowly. Suddenly, from somewhere below, pealed a sharp, bony rattling and an angry, searing hiss. The man threw the light quickly to the right, onto a long gray, perhaps serpentine route, and leapt away forward in 2 chaotic, panicking bounds, spitting repetitively, "Jesus fucking Christ! Jesus fucking Christ!" And after the second leap, and during a third "Jesus fucking Christ," his aimless feet hit the endless pine straw, but the forest floor collapsed beneath his weight, and ripping, crunching sound tore off about him. Light shot out crazily upward into the canopy and the night as he dropped downward into a hole. He landed with a somber thud, and a squeezed, flatulent splash came some 15 feet below, landing on his back, driving his knapsack down into the mushy floor. He lay there motionless, dazed, startled, and humiliated, covered thickly in pine straw and sunk flatly in wet clay mud, holding his black metal flashlight loosely in his hand, running a solitary beam up through a rain of dust and fluttering needles, and into the canopy high above. The squeaking and the chirping were loud and all about him, loud and all about him, and in audible motion. The rattling and hissing were beside him, terribly loud, terribly near, yet audibly drawing no closer. The dank air, putrid with aging death and toxic with waste, slowly pulled to him from both sides and lifted upward in the open night. Something squirmed under his calf and silently fled. He shined the light around frantically, poking crazily in all directions. Before him was a heap of moldy pine needles, laid thickly across much of his green trousers and upon much of his black jacket. Lush heaps of the pine straw had settled at both of his sides. A filthy old sheet draped down from the surface opposite him, lifelessly flopped on a pile of pine straw. To the right was an endless black tunnel, alive with crawling with gray and brown rats. A rainbow assortment of snakes, drifting wisps of thick silver-orange webbing and dank pools of dead red water. To the left, the tunnel continued beyond dense webbing, just as black and just as dank and just as alive with creepies and crawlies. The snakes, for the moment, were standing down or fleeing to safety. The rats ran in endless gray-brown streams along the edges of the floor. He rose to his feet quickly, shooing off the layers of pine straw with underhand swipes, and cast his light about frantically toward each and every sound that sounded off. A racer squirted out from the pine straw in a glossy black meander, and the startled man cast his right hip back. His leg was slow to follow as it labored to tear its foot out from the mud. The racer shot off into the quagmire of serpents and into the darkness to the right. A barking of rattles raged. Out there, not 5 feet away, orgy coils of canebrakes weaved in and out of each other, and a small diamondback was poised to strike, hissing and rattling, but thankfully out of range for the moment. Rats ran crazily along the perimeter, trying desperately to work the wet clay walls around their predators. The man turned to the left again, and the scene was similar, but for a thick copperhead that dashed away from under the heap around him. The last of the snake's tail slithered across the man's left shoe and chased off into the distance. The man stood alone with a flashlight at the bottom of a deep, dank ditch, surrounded by frantic, squealing vermin, writhing and hissing serpents, and dense tangles of festering cobwebs. He cast the ray about in all directions, like a saber hacking away at the abominable darkness, and settled it focused along the length of the hanging sheet. It was a cut of canvas that had soiled orange with clay runoff and pine decay and was frayed with several streaking tear lines at the bottom edge. He reached out for a grab of it with his free hand and gave a sharp tug downward, yielding an unwelcome rain of clump clay and moldy pine needles, but holding fast somehow to the surface above. He jammed the loop end of the flashlight into the waistband of his trousers, throwing an unstable, half-random beam upwards along the front of his jacket. He reached out to the sheet once again, this time grabbing with both hands, and gave another sharp tug, this one broader and heavier than the first. A ripping sequence of tearing cloth bolted down from the top of the wall, and a spray of black dirt and white sand shimmered down upon him. He grabbed higher on the sheet, pulled broadly and heavily again, and the sheet came tumbling down to his forearms and to the ground in a musty dump. Several thick clumps of clay came down around him, landing flatly in the mud. He quickly and skillfully weaved the sheet into a loose, porous fold, bent over, and draped a protective wall about the lower half of his legs, like one might dress a Christmas tree stand. As the man rose upright, the random beam cut into the newfound darkness before him. against the earthen wall, covered with fallen ancient cobwebs, riddled with streaming rats, and woven fluidly with a fiery band of scattering corn snakes, laid a human skeleton draped in stiff cords of rotted canvas tatters. The skull was plastered face first, low into the wall, twisted on a tangle of vertebrae and ribs that had collapsed into a heap on the floor. The heap was interspersed with semi-petrified ribbons of black-orange canvas. The right arm of this unfortunate wanderer, loosely draped in the sickened cloth, was propped up against the wall under a bony hand clutched into the clay, higher up. Its left arm leaned sideways against the skull, running frayed strand of crusted ribbons downward, and its left hand was buried in a gray, squealing stream of cotton rats running at the edge of the floor. Two femur bones were staked into the wet clay like so many ancient fence posts, and a pelvis balanced precariously atop, forming a hellish little Stonehenge. Streams of vermin were thus diverted to and fro, most of which ran between the thigh bones and the wall across the heap of spine and ribs, while others, in the pandemonium of survival, were cast out bodily into the open, scampering across the set of tibia that laid flat on the floor. The skeleton was thus frozen in time, leaving only its last gasp, its desperate clutch, perhaps a unanswered foxhole prayer, and its final remains as testament to a life lost in a dark, dank, lonely, and helpless death. The man, the one with the flattened and muddied backpack, the one with the muddied green khakis and the muddied black jacket and the muddied brown boots, the one with the black metal flashlight, the one with a tattered and musty old bolt of canvas piled around his lower legs, the one pasted with pine needles, the man, the living one, raised himself fully upright in the center of deep clay ditch and drew the flashlight from his waistband. He turned the beam slowly about, monitoring the anguish of the private little hell he had fallen into. Snakes of many varieties were all about, some hissing, some rattling, but none within 6 feet of him, and all were standing down. There were thin, banded snakes of distinct colors, some gray and brown, some brown and black, some black with a single yellow band, some red and gray, some red and black, some red and black and yellow. There were thin, striped snakes, mostly earthly in tone, most streaked in blacks and browns and grays, but some were very colorful, like slithering rainbows entwined in hell's orgy. There were thick, heavy ones, some with rattles and others without. Some were solid with black, long, whip-like tails. Some were bronze and copper with short tails. And some were yellow and white with large orange spots. Some of these larger snakes were brown-gray with large white mouths and equally large fangs. Some were brown and black with exotic diamonds and rattles. Some were black with thin yellow bands, some were slick charcoal black, some were a glossy solid purple, and some were silvery with black spots and rattles. They all slithered and twisted and coiled in and about one another, a living carpet of serpents, inflamed with frequent stabs outbound into the streaking rows of rats. Rats! There were brown rats with short fleshy tails and gray rats with long hairy tails, none particularly large, yet all particularly foul. They ran in steady, reckless streams before him and behind, popping along quickly, staying near to the wall, squeaking and squealing and chirping wildly in an endless race for their lives. Spiders. None plainly visible, but many surely laying hungrily in wait in all the myriad of cobwebs draped from the endless row of musty canvas ceiling swatches down the endless dank corridor. There was a broken stream of reddish puddles in the soft orange mud of the floor, and a heap of pine straw scattered about the square below the open night. There was a smell of decay rushing at him from all directions, and the final remains of the last man to stand in this place. The man, the living one, cast the light upwards along the wall before him. It was thick clay and rusty brown layers, solid and slick, and ran some 15 feet or so up to a thin layer of black dirt and white sand at the surface. He turned and threw the light up at the wall behind him, finding the same formidable properties. He slowly tugged a heavy boot out of the thick mud floor and carefully towed a squishy step up a slick climb toward the stream of rat frenzy. He sunk the foot steadily into the dense orange slime and lunged his left hand out over the swarming mass, carefully maintaining an awkward balance. He reached a hand to the wall and clawed, grabbing fingers into the thin layer of cool mud on the surface. He drew a fistful of wet clay toward his chest and cast a light on it and evaluated its composition. He slopped the mud down to the wet floor, and it smacked flatly beside the frantic stream. He shined the light up the shallow hole he had bored into the wall and leaned forward, reached out, and dug the hand deeper into the clay. He prodded and twisted and scraped at it, but loosed barely a meager clump, which he mindlessly slapped down at the rat highway. A disrupted scurry of surging squeals flared up, and several of the rodents turned back against the grain, causing a sudden pile-up and bouncing a few rats into the open. An eruption of hissing and writhing flared up, not 2 feet from the canvas pile at the man's legs, and one of the larger snakes, one with angry eyes and striped in various shades of brown, thrust forward into the melee and snatched up one of the bounced rats with a single strike. It drew back into the living mounds of twisting and hissing and disappeared. The man bent over slowly and reached down smoothly and grabbed a clutch of the moldy old canvas in his free hand. He worked it into a tighter pile around his legs, and several racing rats bounced up against it. One rat bounced upward toward his face, and he swatted away with the flashlight. The rat flew off into a manic cast of dancing beams and landed deep into the writhing and wiggling darkness. Another flare of hissing erupted. The man pulled a stretch of the stiff cloth upward above his knees and raised himself upright. He scanned the periphery, casting the beam in a loose circle around him. Several of the snakes had migrated into the pine straw heap behind him, closing his circle a little tighter. He switched the flashlight to his cruddy left hand and reached his right hand to his shoulder. He grabbed the strap of his backpack and, with about a contorted tilts and gyrations, wiggled the arm freed. The pack slapped leftward behind him and hung from his left shoulder. He reached across his chest, grabbed the dangling pack, and drew his left hand and the flashlight backward through the left side strap. Holding the pack by a strap with his right hand, he turned slowly in the canvas heap, tugging his boots about the wet, muddy slop, and faced the bulging and writhing pine straw heap. He raised the pack to his shoulder and suddenly slapped it down on the floor. Snakes hissed and scattered in all directions. One, a pale gray rattler with jagged black bands and a single brown stripe, lunged at the pack and gave it a quick little kiss. It paused momentarily. Then it receded back across the pine straw heap and into the general population. The man carefully dragged and lifted the pack back toward him and cast a light onto the straw heap. He looped his right hand with a strap and slid the pack over his shoulder. He switched a flashlight to his right hand and swiped his left hand along his right shirt sleeve, removing clumps of orange clay and black canvas mold. He reached a dirty hand into the pocket of his trousers, shuffled fingers around, and dug deeper. He drew out a small, thick, red pocket knife and scanned the floor. He tucked the flashlight back into his armpit and pried open a blade. He turned back to the rear wall, carefully managing the pile of canvas while tugging at and sliding his boots from and through the orange slop. The rats flew by in front of him, squeaking and squealing. He leaned forward and reached carefully across the racing rats, struggling a bit to maintain balance. He lurched his left hand forward and stabbed the pocket knife blade about eye high into the wet clay wall. He sliced a downward line through through the clay, a line about 18 inches in length. He pulled the blade out and stabbed it back into the wall, and this time some 12 inches to the left. He drew downward again, creating a parallel line, again about 18 inches in length. He pulled the blade and stabbed back in. He drew a crossing line connecting the tops of the vertical cuts and pulled the blade. He stabbed in and drew another horizontal line, joining the vertical cuts about halfway down, and then drew another, maybe 3 inches below. He stabbed a knife into the wall to his right and jammed the flashlight between his legs. He dug at the wall where he had cut the pattern and loosed a few handfuls of the hard, wet clay. He carefully threw them down to the floor behind him and onto the writhing edge of the mass of snakes. They hissed in an angry, airy bark, but meekly retreated, slinking back into themselves. The man turned back to the wall and resumed slashing and hacking and digging. He collected another clump of clay and turned and tossed it down. As the clay splattered flatly and the snake's hisses retreated, a beam of light engulfed him from above. He slowly turned to face it, looking first to the squealing and squeaking rat-infested pile of bones across a ditch, then slowly up the length of the tall clay wall. He finally peered into the brightness cast upon him, seeing nothing but the bright white circular source against the black of the endless night. Then a warm drizzle spattered down from behind him, slapping heavily across his neck and shoulders. He turned and threw his light up along the back wall and caught a yellow stream descending downward from the night. He turned his face away, wincing in disgust, and surveyed the darkness of the tunnel depths to his left with a sweep of the flashlight. He folded up the pocket knife against his left hip and jammed it into his pants pocket. The yellow stream faded to squirts and drips, and behind him and the rats along the back wall got a dousing and freaked, raising a huff of mania. The man bent over slightly and grabbed a musty old sheet with his left hand. He looked up to the light and turned and peered up the wall behind him. There was a sudden double clicking from behind. The light rose up and away from the front, and then a second similar double clicking sound. The man suddenly peeled his left boot from the mud, then his right. He lurched out into the single beam of his flashlight into the mass of snakes on the dank, dark floor, laboring to run with canvas wrapping dangled on his legs and caked heavy boots sinking with every step. Light came down from his right as he pushed through the angry hisses and bony rattles. Most snakes parted his path. Some struck at him. An explosion ripped off with a flash from his left, and the man lost his footing. He fell face first over the draped sheet and into the festering slime. He pulled his head out of the mud. Snakes struck at him from all directions. He howled out and then screamed. He struggled to pull himself out of the mud, but failed. The light in his left hand shined on, forward into the low, dank reaches. Whips of fangs snapped at it, and at his wrists, and at his arms, and at his shoulders. He looked forward and was bit twice on the face. He slammed his face into the mud. Another shot rang out from above, jolting the man to the right, then another tossing him to the left. He howled. He moaned. He pined. He whimpered. He dug his right hand into the clay mud bottom in a vast, last, desperate clutch of life, and then his spirit left him. All of his will fell in a droop, and the snakes overwhelmed him. Adios.
Thank you for tuning into Postalin Monologics.
Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.